Hello and welcome back to the Album Files podcast. Shockingly, we are here for another episode. It's only been hiatus, but a couple of us made trips to Belgium. One of us went to Mexico. It was a lot of moving around, but we're back. We're back now, and it's me, Abby Mickey. I'm joined by Matt Deneve.
Hello. It's good to be back again. I'm excited that we managed to get us all together again. We've got a good one to talk about this week, I reckon.
Ian Treloar.
Hi. I feel like I should probably let something slip from behind the curtain, which was before we started recording, Abby was like certain that we were never, ever going to record another episode of the Album Files. And
that's
the fact
not what I said.
Absolutely said that. You're like, I'm shocked that we're doing this. I'm not shocked. I always knew we'd be back. Can't keep these three apart.
I knew we would be back eventually.
Oh, okay. But I thought I interpreted that with a lot more finality. I thought you thought that a month apart and we'd just never speak about music or anything with each other ever again.
Just
and it would just linger awkwardly in any conversation we had in the future. Like, remember that podcast? Ooh.
That was a weird thing that we did for nobody.
Matt and I's 10 days working together in August would be like super awkward.
Anytime music came on, it'd be like, ooh. Yeah.
This no, is, I wouldn't this is play music in the car. It would be like silence or an audiobook.
Well, you two can go and start your little book podcast and I'll have a solo project.
Just you talking to yourself?
Me talking honestly, to myself I'd about to about like weird black metal or something.
I'd listen to that.
Same. Appealing than the three of us talking about whatever it is that we talk about.
What do we talk about? Music. Today, we're going to talk about Neutral Milk Hotels in the Airplane Over the Sea, but before we dive into that, in the last month, a new Beyoncé album has come out, and I feel like I've said this on the podcast before. I'm not like a huge Beyoncé fan. I've never really like gotten the Beyoncé hype. In preparation for the album Cowboy Carter, I knew that I was excited to listen to the album because there was some country leaning to it, and I am a Colorado girl, so country music is in my blood. So I was excited to hear Cowboy Carter, but I wanted to listen to some of her other stuff, and I like totally fell in love with Lemonade, great album. And I get the Beyonce hype now. And yeah, so I just was listening to a lot of Beyonce, just Beyonce on repeat.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I haven't listened to all of Cowboy Carter yet, but it's definitely on my list of albums I want to listen to. And what I've heard of it so far, the first, I don't know, half or something, seems really good. So were you impressed by it? Is it as country as we thought it was going to be? I know there's a few tracks that are country leaning, but is it a country album?
No, honestly, I don't think it is. And I feel like actually the like hype leading up to the album that was like pushing it as a country album actually almost takes away from the album. I also think that she has a couple cameos in there from like Willie Nelson and Dolly Parton that I think are not really that necessary. Like I feel like the only qualm I have with the album is that it seems like she's trying to take a dig at country for not being a more welcoming place to black women, which fair, but I also think that it takes away from the album itself. Whereas if she hadn't had those cameos in there, then it would have been, and even I even don't think the Dolly Parton cover that she has on there that broke the internet, I didn't love it that much. I feel like it takes away from the album itself. Like the talking points around the album were all about who she had on the album, whereas I feel like there are songs where the music stands on its own that just didn't need that. It didn't need that whole layering on top of it. The cover of Blackbird, the Beatles song,
yeah,
that she did, it's amazing. It's so good. And she has a couple of women, black women, who are in the country music bubble who are lesser known. She had them come on that song and sing with her, which I felt like was a bajillion times more powerful than Dolly Parton having a line on the album.
Yeah, I listened to Blackbird tonight and yeah, it seemed good. I was surprised that it seems like she's used the original guitar track. Is that right? I don't know, you might have read up on this, but it's...
Yeah, I think so. I read that Paul McCartney helped to produce the song.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. It's definitely one I want to go and listen to properly. I even downloaded it for the trip to Belgium recently, but just never got around to it. But yeah, it certainly got people talking, that's for sure.
Yeah. Matt, what have you been listening to? if it's not Cowboy Carter.
A lot of Lizzie McAlpine's older, which I think we agreed before recording this that we're going to do a special bonus episode specifically about that.
That's he right, says yeah. like we didn't just talk about it and agree upon it.
You guys might have changed your mind. We're going to do a bonus episode all about Lizzie McAlpine's new album called Older. Yeah, I'll save all my thoughts for that episode, but I've been listening to that a bunch. I know you have as well, Ian. We were listening to that together in a van on the way up to Amsterdam recently.
Wasn't that cute?
Yeah, look at us go. So a lot of that. Jacob Collier's Jesse Volume 4, which I think I talked about in the last episode, wanting to listen to that. And, oh boy, there's a lot in there to digest, and it's very, very good. I even had a brief moment where I thought maybe it would be the next album I recommended for us to all listen to. Because I think there's enough there that would make it a really interesting discussion. So, you mentioned this last time, Abby, Little Blue, the Brandi Carlile song, is stunning. And the Mahogany Sessions version of that that's on YouTube is incredible. Incredible. And Bridge Over Troubled Waters. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff on this album that is really very, very good. So, I would highly recommend it if you are interested in Jacob Collier's kind of maximalist vibe and also his, yeah, just his quality songwriting, I think. So, yeah, they're the main ones. And, yeah, looking forward to talking about Lizzie McAlpine in particular probably next week, I guess.
Me? Is it my turn? As an audio medium, I think Abby just, like, pointing at me in the video is probably not instructive for the listener, but I could have made that more seamless than I did.
Yep.
I think we can agree. So, what I've been listening to is just my usual dumb bullshit. There is a 2017 EP by Sadness called Circle of Veins, which has been getting a whole lot of play over the last week and has some of their best songs and just some incredible, incredible stuff. Whilst I was over in Belgium, there was a new EP that came out from Sylvain, who is a Norwegian-American female black metal / folk musician who does some interesting sort of Norwegian folk music influenced metal. And that's a really, really pretty EP. Very atmospheric, very haunting, and doesn't have her growling at all, I don't think. So that's a refreshing change. Lizzie McAlpine.
Quite a combination.
Older. Sorry?
That's quite a combination. Norwegian folk and black metal.
Yeah, although there are a couple. So there's two that are very similar. Myrkur, who is Danish, but also has that folk and black metal influence. She's really similar. There's a band called Gorta, who, I don't know, it's a whole thing. Female-fronted Norwegian folk with metal influences. So, yeah, it's good. And Sylvain is good. So, Lizzie McAlpine, yes, I think I can't remember the timeline of when we last recorded because it is about like 6 weeks ago. But I was
it that long ago?
I think it is because there was Belgium and then you were flitting around.
There's some family illness stuff as well, and
then I was Mia was sick for a while. So yeah, like it's been a while. So I can't remember if I'd just been to see a bunch of gigs in a week. Whether I was just about to.
Yeah, you had a week of, yeah, I remember that.
So I saw Tim Hecker, and that was really good. I was very happy with that. So, yeah, I think it's been a big sort of writing period for me, which means a lot of Sadness, a lot of Tim Hecker, a lot of loud music with some Lizzie McAlpine in a van.
I have to, like, with the Lizzie McAlpine, and I'm sure we're going to talk more about her new album next week, obviously, if we're going to do this special bonus episode that has been floated around.
What do you guys think? Should we do an episode?
I mean, we've all called it.
There was a moment while you guys were in Belgium, Matt messaged me that you and him were both sitting in the back of the car listening to it with headphones on. It's a really funny mental image.
It was very dark and very late, and we were all absolutely rooted because it was the day of Paris-Roubaix, the men's race, and we'd done the women's race the day before. And for some godforsaken reason, we had to drive from France, from Roubaix, to Kortrijk, which was like a 2-hour drive or something.
In Belgium,
and then yeah. from there to Amsterdam, to our hotel, via Brussels. So it was about 5 hours in the van after 2 days of heavy work. And everyone was just tired and nobody was talking much. And we were just sort of listening to Lizzie McAlpin in the dark, like little sad, lonely boys.
Really
in the
atmospheric.
Van.
Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about it next week if we do this episode, but very moody, very moody.
Anyway, I think we should talk about Neutral Milk Hotel. It's been 6 weeks on the back burner, this album. So, Matt, you want to give us a little bit of a primer?
I will. I'll try and keep it as brief as I can, rather than just talking at everybody for half an hour. But, quick version is Neutral Milk Hotel are a lo-fi / indie rock group, I guess you'd say, from Louisiana. That kind of grew out of some home recording projects by their founder, Jeff Mangum. Which he kind of started back in high school. He played in a bunch of bands after finishing school, but Neutral Milk Hotel would ultimately be the project that he'd pour most of his creative energy into. The band existed from 1989 to 1998 and recorded two albums in that time. The first of those called On Avery Island in 1996, and then the one we're talking about today, In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, in 1998. The second and final album. They did reunite in 2013 for a couple of years, I think, before disbanding again, but their main period of work and touring and that sort of thing was, early 90s, I guess you'd say. Through the late 90s. So In the Aeroplane Over the Sea came out in 1998. Had some initial positive reviews, but I think the kind of received wisdom about this album is that it really developed its biggest following in the months and years afterwards. They went on tour afterwards to support the album, and it started to get popular, which didn't sit all that well with Jeff Mangum, who kind of withdrew from the public eye as much as he could. But as time went on, and this was at the early days of the internet, the band kind of grew in popularity and sort of almost developed into something of a cult group, a cult following, this album, this band. And I think now looking back at their work, you'd probably say that this is their crowning glory and certainly their best known album. And for many, it's regarded as a landmark album in the indie rock space and one of the most important albums in the 90s. And I always like to see how Pitchfork reviews albums because I think they tend to be pretty harsh, and I think it's worth noting that at the time this came out, they gave it an 8.7 out of 10, and then in 2005, when the reissue of this album came out, they gave it a 10 out of 10, which is very rare indeed. A significant album. I think we talked about this in the last episode about how, you know, whether you'd consider it a cult classic, and I think it does kind of have that status in the indie rock space. In terms of why I recommended it as one to talk about, I think, well, obviously there is a lot to talk about in this album. It's quite an evocative piece of work, but I first came across it probably, how long ago would that be? Maybe 6 years ago, something like that, almost by accident. I was listening to some other indie rock album on Spotify and kind of got to the end of it, and as Spotify likes to do, it started serving up stuff that was in a similar sort of vein. And I think one of the tracks that it played for me was Two-Headed Boy. I can't remember if it was the first part or the second part that's on this album. But I remember listening to that and my attention being pulled away from whatever I was working on at that moment and being quite struck by this piece of music. I went back and listened to the whole album and had a really strong reaction to it. And I remember messaging you at the time, Ian. We were working together in South Melbourne at the time. And I was like, oh, have you heard of these guys, Neutral Milk Hotel? And I remember your response at the time was something like, oh, yes, Jeff Mangum, reclusive genius, or something like that was the line you used.
Jesus Christ. Which sounds like the kind of wanky bullshit that I would just send in a Slack message. Cool.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, he does have a reputation for being reclusive, Jeff Mangum, and you know, if you want to learn more about him and the band, there's a wealth of information out there that's worth diving into. But this album, more than just about anything else I've ever listened to, gave me a strong feeling when I first listened to it of, and I'm just summing up how I felt in the moment, which was, oh, this is really something. And I had this sense of occasion, like this felt like a milestone moment for me in my music listening, that hasn't happened very often apart from that. So one other album that stands out to me that did that was, and Ian, you'll laugh at this, but Mars Volta's Francis the Mute. I had the same feeling there as I did with this one, where it was just kind of like, right, pay attention, because this is something that's going to stick with me, and this is important. This is going to be important for me and my musical journey. I think the reason for that is there's a real heft to this album, a real emotional heft that I kind of find difficult to articulate. So apologies if I kind of ramble a bit here, but lyrically and thematically, it's really quite obtuse and cryptic and hard to make sense of. And for me, that actually makes the whole thing more intriguing. It's kind of impenetrable in a lot of ways, and unknowable. There are some discernible themes, like, you know, loss and a bunch of references to Anne Frank and some rather visceral descriptions of sex and stuff. But there's also a really like dark and unsettling, an almost haunting vibe that I find really fascinating about this album. And we can talk more about the kind of body horror stuff later on, because I'm sure that'll come up. But there's a lot here to unpack, I think, a lot musically and tonally. And I was listening to this today on a ride when I was out riding my bike, and it kind of, the way I found myself making sense of it was, it almost is like a circus or carnival act from the old days, where they kind of delight in, you know, freak shows and kind of laughing at other people's misfortune, in that kind of vibe almost, which makes it sound maybe darker and more grotesque than it is. But I think there are some like quite creepy things going on in this album. And I want to open up to you guys to give your initial thoughts, because I'm sure the rest of the stuff that I have written down will come out as we go through it. But I adore this album, and I think there's a lot to love about it. But I think it's a very complex and deep album as well. And yeah, love to hear you guys' thoughts about it. Ian, I know you had a lot of, you spent a lot of time with this group before I did. So keen for your thoughts.
I think that was a really nice summary of what this album is. I think that it is such a complex album, and it is a really interesting album because of that. But the sort of thing that I come back to with it is that it's such a wholly contained package, from like the album art, which fits the vibe of the sort of body horror, to the like even in that album art, it does have that kind of carnivalesque vibe to it. The lyrics match that, the instrumentation matches that. I think as a whole, it works together in a way that you don't often see in music and in the packaging and the whole experience of it. It's quite distinct in that way. I think that your assessment of it, or like the perceived wisdom of it as a cult classic, is pretty bang on. It's an important album, and it's an influential album, and without this album, you don't have bands like Arcade Fire or the Decemberists or Ockable River or Beirut or like a bunch of those indie rock bands that have brass and weird instrumentation and kind of musical approach that looks backward into like Salvation Army kind of brass band kind of stuff and funeral waltzes and all this kind of stuff. Like it's a really interesting musical product that draws from about a 100 years plus of musical vocabulary. And I really love that. And also the way that it incorporates like these really fuzzy guitars and sounds just kind of scuzzy in parts. And yeah, it's a fascinating listen. I'm kind of cautious and concerned about what Abby will think about it.
Yeah. Yep. I feel the same.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had the least, I'd never heard of Neutral Milk Hotel or this album before the last episode. The first couple listens through, I really enjoyed it. Like the kind of weird, like psychedelic type instrumentation, like musical bits captured me in the beginning in the first couple listens. And then as I kind of listened more to the lyrics, I started to really hate the album. What is this guy's fascination with semen? Like, I think he mentioned semen in like
is there another
more than half of the songs.
Two different songs. It's like, yeah, is there another album that's ever been released that mentions semen in more than one song?
Yeah, and I could do without it. There's also one line in Comely that's like, your father made fetuses with flesh-licking ladies, which gives me, like, makes my body shiver. I just hate that. That line hits and I'm like, nope, skip. I hate this song for so many reasons. But I really loved a lot about the album. Like, I felt really pulled in two different directions because when it came to the actual musical aspects of the album, like especially the two musical interlude type song tracks, The Fool and Untitled, I feel like those two were my favorite. And I think it's because there weren't any lyrics. And so I felt just super conflicted about the album as a whole, which I guess makes sense now listening to you guys talk about it and its history. There was a lot of the lyrics and the lead singer that I was just like, this is not for me, but I still found it fun to listen to and enjoyed putting it on when I did.
Yeah, I mean, the body horror stuff, I wouldn't begrudge anybody that finds this uncomfortable to listen to. There are some just really gross lines. How I would push my fingers through your mouth to make those muscles move. And you watched as your brains fell out through your teeth. Like, it's just the album is full of it.
Oh, I wrote that one down too.
Yeah, it's all super icky, but that stuff doesn't bother me so much and in fact makes it all the more intriguing for some reason. It's like, it's something you don't hear very often, I don't think, in music or in the music like this. There's other genres where you hear viscerally disgusting stuff a lot more, but I found it quite engaging.
I don't think that the body horror stuff, as you put it, is that disgusting, really. Like, I think it's, I mean, yes, objectively it is disgusting, but I don't think that what it's trying to do with those lyrics is to be disgusting. I think it's somebody with like a childish mentality or something, like trying to articulate sexuality in a way that they don't have the vocabulary for. So like fingers lacing through the notches of your spine. I don't listen to that album, to that lyric and think, oh, yuck. I listen to that and I'm like, okay, this is somebody that's sort of like grasping for sexual connection with somebody and they're expressing it in these really sort of blunt terms. But I don't think it's like horror. I think it's just like that sort of messy side of sexuality.
But expressed. It doesn't feel blunt to me. It doesn't feel like somebody grasping for words they don't understand. It feels like deliberately florid to me. It feels like somebody who's actually very good at describing what they're doing or, you know, and is going to lengths to try and paint a picture in a visceral way rather than being more direct about it. I see what you're saying, but
I don't know. Like, I think some of it is almost beautiful. Like, Now we move to feel for ourselves inside some stranger's stomach. Let your skin begin to blend itself with mine. Like, I think that that kind of physicality, that sexuality is really interesting. And it's not pretty, but it's...
Yeah, no, I think it's engaging. I think it's beautifully written. I think it's smart writing and evocative writing. But I do think it does, for me, it does still evoke a feeling of like, ugh, this is uncomfortable to listen to, even if it is engaging and clever, I guess.
Yeah, I think you also have to, like, the flip side of that sort of positive, not positive, but the more explicitly sexual stuff is there's this quite sort of grotesque and blunt way where they talk about things like war crimes and the Holocaust and Anne Frank, and one of the lyrics is, I know they buried her body with others, her sister and brothers and 500 mm-hmm. families. And I think that the juxtaposition of that with the more sexual talk is really fascinating, because it's often within the same song. It's just this whole worldview that is fascinating and kind of horny and kind of terrifying and kind of bleak. And I think that that's a big part of the appeal of this album and of Jeff Mangum's songwriting, because it does encapsulate all of that. Like, I would not want to be in the guy's head. I don't want to think what he's thinking or feel what he's feeling. But fuck, yeah. He's feeling everything, and he's feeling it so strongly. And I think that in itself is really interesting. And the music matches that. Like, all of the music is all of these things all at once. There's just his voice. There's these strange buzzing sounds, these strange whistling sounds. It's a lot, but I think as a reflection of a person and his mind in its warped complexity, it's a really true reflection.
And being able to convey that is really impressive. Like, it's one thing to be able to get the words out or get the music out, but being able to, create this whole package that conveys that experience or conveys that mental state or that way of seeing the world, I think is what makes it so compelling for me. Like, it is... Like we said before, the basic themes you can pick up on from the lyrics, but it is also pretty hard to know. It's not entirely clear what it's all about, really. A lot of it's very cryptic, and that's kind of appealing to me as well. It's nice to not really know. You just kind of take it on this crazy, weird journey where you're kind of... I don't know, it's almost like a... like a theme park ride where you're just getting like flashes of weird stuff on the side as you go through this haunted house or something. I don't know. It's all very strange.
That's such a great way to describe it.
Yeah, and you're getting like splashed
like whiplash,
with,
a little you know, bit.
Yeah, random like, liquids, what the fuck was you that? Know. Yeah, what was that? And it happens again. You're like, oh man. Yeah, it's a lot, but I think the overall
effect.
I got
semen on my shoulder.
Not the semen.
Yeah,
not
it's a
the
lot.
Semen. Anything but semen.
Oh, I went through semen alley, and now I can't get it out of my hair.
I was listening to this album on my run, and this morning, like getting ready to talk about it, and like I think it was Communist Daughter,
Communist Daughter,
he just sings semen stains the mountaintops over and over and over.
You're just cringing every
time.
Just
like, grossed out face. Yeah. Grossed out facial expression.
Yep.
And my notes just say hard pass.
Oh, totally get it.
But it is kind of like I mean, if you've got semen on your mind, which this guy obviously does. Like, it's quite a if you remove the fact that it's semen on the mountaintops, then you're just like, oh yeah. That probably does look like a fresh sprinkling of snow. And you'd
no,
be like, oh, that's...
No, it's not just that there's semen on the mountaintops, Ian. It's that the semen has been there for so long that it's stained the mountaintops. Or or it's such an abundance of semen.
To move away from the semen talk, I think that part of what really works on this album for me is the contrast of those really abstract thoughts and ideas, the more plain sort of spoken or plainly written lines that really hit you in the gut. Like in Two-Headed Boy Part 2, you have the line, "She will feed you tomatoes and radio wires," which is, oof, okay, cool. Like that is not a dietary thing. But then on the flip side, there's this line which kills me every time I hear it, which is, "In my dreams, you're alive and I'm crying." And that's mm-hmm. just like a knife to the heart.
It also comes at that kind of rousing point in the song as well. Like that's, I'm not sure if that's the chorus or the bridge or whatever it is, but the song picks up there as well. It just, yeah, it gets you real good.
Yeah. So I love that there's space for both of those things in an album, in a song, all of this in one album. And it's not long. It's like less than 40 minutes and you have 11 tracks, all of which flow together beautifully. Mm. Everything works really nicely. It feels contained. There's long songs, there's short songs, there's as much semen, a smorgasbord of semen. Where are you getting that kind of value?
If we were savvy enough to be creating social media clips to promote our podcast, that would be it right there. That line. It's a smorgasbord of semen. Where else to get that kind of value?
We do have a Twitter. We could just put that out with no explanation.
Yeah, I mean, the variety.
We'll lose all 200 of our followers.
Exactly, yeah. They're gone. No, you're right, Ian. The variety here is, you know, I love variety in an album and it's got it in spades here. And I'm a bit surprised that you enjoy it so much because I feel like sometimes you feel like things get a bit unfocused if they're long and short and heavy and soft and all over the place, but this gels for you somehow?
I think it's been part of my life for 20 years, so
right.
I don't know what I would think of it if I came to it for the first time now. Maybe not much, but it got me at a time that this was very much my thing, and listening back to it now, it's so familiar and something that I've listened to so many times and really love. Like it's a important album for me that I think I'm almost blind to some of those kind of faults. Semen? Maybe I miss.
Maybe
that.
We should have a semen count for
that. Oh, semen!
How many times?
I'm confident that we haven't used that word as much in any other podcast before.
I am confident that we haven't used that word as much as it was spoken on the album.
That's true. Ian, you talked before about Jeff Mangum's voice, and I want to talk a bit more about that because I think it's obviously at the heart of this album. You know, in the past, we've talked about this kind of idea of rough and unpolished voices and what they add to an album. And I think this is a really great example of how powerful it can be. You know, there are times in this album where he's at the absolute limit of his vocal range, just really barely hanging on, like in Two-Headed Boy. There are times when he drops out of key. There are times when he just runs out of breath. There are other moments where he just sounds quite shaky. And I think there's a beautiful, organic kind of honesty to that that would be tempting to kind of wallpaper over, to re-record, to smooth out, but it's kind of there in all its unpolished glory, and his voice is great, and it's so passionate and so rousing. And I think it really fits the vibe of the project as a whole. You know, there are other parts that aren't quite right. You know, the Irish bagpipes that play at times are just like out of key at times for good chunks of songs. The horns on King of Carrot Flowers Part 2 and 3, just all over the shop, like somebody who's just learned to play trumpet. But it all just kind of works. It's all kind of sloppy in this really endearing way that sort of reflects the chaotic mood of the entire piece. And I think it just works brilliantly.
Yeah, it's got a kind of ramshackle charm.
I feel like if his, yeah, I think if his vocal range had been better, if the vocals in general had been better quality, then it actually wouldn't fit with the sound of the album itself. Like, I feel like it would be, it would feel off. Like, it would feel like it just wasn't right there. Like, the same way that Taylor Swift's vocals in her early albums fit the vibe of the songs, you know, like her early vocals in Fearless just matched the innocent kind of like girl growing up feeling of that album. The same thing I think could be said here, where Mangum's vocals like just seamlessly fit with the low quality of the music itself.
I think that the interesting thing about his vocal performance is that it's not just that he strains at the limits of his range, but he also has some real weird phrasing. Like, it's this strange, broadly accented voice, and instead of saying the, he says the, and there's a bunch of other examples of just, it adds to this sense of this album being from this different time or different place, where it's kind of, yeah, you can't really pinpoint where the narrator is coming from in the last 100 years, or whether he is from where in America is from, or like it's a really odd and distinctive thing.
Yeah, I think if you had his, if his vocals were more polished and more produced and in key and all that kind of stuff, then it would make the rest of the instrumentation feel really jarring, and you'd have to fix that up as well, and then you just end up in a place that's so far from where it is currently. The lo-fi-ness of it really is a big part of the appeal for me. It felt like there were kind of two gears to the album. There's the acoustic lead stuff, your two-headed boy and O Comely, that sort of side of the album, and then the heavier distorted stuff, so like Holland 1945 as an example of that, and you got some kind of weirder stuff around the fringes, I guess, but I felt like there were two gears to that. And yeah, coming back to what you said before, Ian, it felt like that mix was really nice, and you kind of bounce around between these vibes. But I think for me, the emotional heart of it and the kind of the bits that grabbed me the most were those acoustic moments. Two-headed boy, probably the second part in particular, the closing track, is just gut-wrenchingly beautiful, I think. And O Comely, I think, has a real, I used this phrase before, but emotional heft to it. It just feels like a real journey. It goes to a bunch of places, and yeah, the lyrics are gross, but yeah, it takes you on this journey. It's so haunting, and the way he goes from the end of a chorus into a verse, going from kind of like this upbeat major chord sequence down back to this really haunting minor chords in the verse, is just really powerful. And yeah, the acoustic stuff stands out to me the most. I thought that was really powerful.
I think O Comely for me is the clear standout song on the album. It is the longest song on the album by almost like twice as much as any other song, over 8 minutes long. But it doesn't feel like it. It kind of goes through these different movements. It's one of the most stripped back parts of the album, but then segues into this beautiful brass outro, and then there's this like popping tuba line that descends towards the end of it. And I also think that it's one of the most assured vocal performances on the album. There's like this octave leap that he does where he sort of slides up an entire octave. It's so stripped back and sparse, and the way that the melody and the lyrics flow is, it just takes you on this journey. It's really beautiful work. Two-Headed Boy Part 2 is another favorite of mine. I think In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, I'd actually put that in the other camp. Like, it is of being one of the more upbeat sort of rockier songs on the album, even though it's just him and an acoustic guitar. But it feels like more. It feels like not one of the singles on the album, but like it is one of the ones where you're like, oh, okay, this is a more upbeat moment.
That's one with a sloppy trumpet, right?
I will also say, whilst we're talking about vocal performances, that there is one moment that I really don't like on this album.
Is which it is Jesus Christ?
Yeah, you got it.
It's funny, isn't it? It just comes out of nowhere. It's so strange compared to the rest of that track and really the rest of the album.
Yeah, it's pretty polarizing.
When I was listening to that, my notes are, oh, yeah, I like this. This is good. I have a good feeling about this album. Nope, never mind. And then I wrote the G, and I actually spelled it out with many E's, S's, and U's and stuff. The Jesus Christ did me in.
Yeah.
It's a questionable moment.
I think it just goes back to what you were saying, Ian, about this being like this pastiche of different time periods and different genres and different feels and everything. It's just like this moment that feels like it's been grabbed from a different time and just rammed into this song that would be totally fine without it. And yeah, I mean, I definitely understand the argument that it doesn't work, but I don't know. It's all just part of it to me. I don't know. It's, again, coming back to that analogy of being on the theme park ride, it's just like another weird thing that pops up and you're like, oh, okay, that's odd, but what's next, you know?
Semen.
From Jesus Christ to semen. But I guess that is kind of like the two poles. Like, it's kind of sacred and profane and all of that in one album.
It's a great point. Abby, I'm curious, what are the songs that you liked the most or hated the least, maybe?
No, there were songs that I legitimately enjoyed. The King of Carrot Flowers Part 1, the opening song, I really like, which is why I thought that this would not be... I think I will like this, was my notes upon first listen. And yeah, I like that one. I really like it, In the Airplane Over the Sea. And Holland 1945, I like as well. Although the lyrics are very chaotic, but I don't think that that's, again, not the strongest part of the album as a whole. So, or not the part that I would like to, I need to not think about the lyrics because then I won't like the album at all. So if I don't think about the lyrics and I think about just how the vocals fit in with the music and actually like the chaotic nature of the lyrics in that song, it doesn't make any sense anyway. So it's easy to like that song, I feel like. Mm. And then, yeah, both of the songs with no words, Untitled and The Fool. I like those two as well. So
yeah,
definitely some strong moments on the album that I did enjoy.
I want to get your thoughts on Untitled because I wrote down here, sounds like a Ringo Starr Beatles track, kind of like Flying from the Magical Mystery Tour meets Octopus's Garden. Did you have Beatles vibes?
I wrote down it's giving Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yep. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Like, you just get these totally moments.
Like,
yeah.
It felt like when the Beatles shifted and started doing more drugs is how that song kind of made me feel. And I would be shocked to find that there wasn't drugs involved in the making of this album.
It's probably a fair bet, I'd say. Without wanting to cast aspersions too much.
This is 1998, you know.
Yeah, and The Fool is great too. I think you're right. The instrumentals, just really good. Just that drunken, waltzy dirge. It's kind of, it's just so well executed, I think. And I think that's the one that made me think about the carnival vibe that I mentioned earlier. I was like, yeah, this is just like a circus show, this whole thing. And this is like,
I mean,
the whole company after a big night, just on the drink, just kind of reminiscing about the day or something. I don't know. It's just pretty evocative.
Two-Headed Boy, Into the Fool also, that could just be one song. The transition is so seamless between those two that a lot of times I didn't realize that the song had changed, which I like, especially when you're thinking about the album as a whole, which is the point of this podcast. Mm. So I felt like that was I liked that moment, even if Two-Headed Boy was not one of my favorite songs. Sorry, guys.
There are a lot of those good moments that flow, though, aren't there? I think there's more than half the tracks flow nicely into the next one. And it does have this real sense of mm-hmm. progression as you go through. Ian, I felt like I cut you off before.
On the carnival ride thing, I think that The Fool is where the carnival is working, as it should. And then Untitled is where the carnival is falling apart. And everything's out of time with everything else. And it's like slowing down and speeding up and smoke's coming out everywhere. It looks...
Yeah, you're thinking, wait, has this had a safety check in the last... When was the last time that this was checked by a professional?
Somebody has not, like, talked the bolts to spec.
But how cool that it's so evocative, though, right? I don't think there's many albums that I've listened to that transport me to a place and a vibe quite like that. You know, it makes you feel like you're on this ride, which I think that's really powerful.
I think musically that, but I know that the lyrics weren't your favorite bit of this at all, Abby, but I think that to me is almost the strongest part of the album because it's so vivid and so strange and so economical, but like unusual with the choice of words. It's so surreal and laced with this kind of physicality that you can see everything. And even if you can't see it or can't understand what this image is that's being presented to you, you get some sort of mental picture of it. I think that as a piece of lyricism, it's incredible. And I really love that side of it.
That's fair. I can totally see where you're coming from. I just don't want those images in my brain.
Yeah, I'm closer to you on this, Anne. I think for someone who doesn't really... Like, the lyrics are kind of secondary a lot of the time for me. I was quite captivated as well by the storytelling and the choice of words. But I do 100% see why you find that off-putting, Abby, and wouldn't begrudge you or anybody else for feeling that way. It's a lot. It's a lot to take in. And quite in your face, as it were.
I mean, it's not going to like steer me away from listening to the album again. I guarantee that I'll listen to it again. And perhaps, you know, on more listens, I'll come full circle to the first time I listened to it. That's not out of the question. I think maybe running when you have nothing to do but listen to the lyrics is perhaps not the best way to consume this album. And maybe if I find a better way to listen to it, then I will like it more. Because I do find the more that we do this podcast, that how I listen to the album, like in what setting I'm in, directly influences how I feel about it after a certain number of listens.
I think extremely jet lagged is a really good time to listen to this. I wrote all of my notes for this after like 30 hours on a plane. So... Matthew, you said in your little intro spiel that when you first heard it, you were like, oh, this is going to be a landmark album for me.
Mm.
Was that just like a first impression thing, or did it stand up to that?
It's a tricky thing to explain that feeling because I don't know. I don't really know how to describe it other than I was hooked by it immediately. It took all of my attention away from everything else and demanded that I listen to it. And every time I listen to it since, I'm like, this is something. That's the phrase I keep coming back to. This is really something. And it just feels like it feels significant. And I don't really know how to describe it beyond that. It feels like something that I'm really glad that I got a chance to experience, and that every time I listen to it, I'm really glad that it exists. And I don't know, you know, my brother Ash, who's a musician, as you know, long-time listeners of the podcast will know, he listened to this album just on his way home. We were just caught up before, and he he messaged about this album, and he was just saying that he described it as so raw, weird, and wonderful, and that he hears my solo stuff in there. That stuff that I write is kind of similar to this. And I hadn't really thought about that, but I think it must have had an impact. And I know definitely the, you know, Two-Headed Boy, both parts of that have definitely had an impact on me. And I think in that regard, yeah, it's been a landmark album for me for sure. It's informed how I approach songwriting. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but it felt significant when I listened to it, and it feels significant every time I listen to it since. So I guess that's a yes.
Do you think that part of the significance of this album, or part of this album's legacy, is the fact that it is this kind of flash in the pan? Like, it's 25 years and they're... 25 years? Have I got my maths right? Yeah, 25 years since the album came out. There's been nothing new from them since. Like, it's like this singular artistic statement put out by this tortured genius, or like this weird guy, and then he just sort of disappears, and that is that. Like, it is this album, would this album have the same hype around it if it was followed by another album in the Aeroplane Over the Sea Part 2 like 3 years later or whatever?
I think there's two answers to that. I think for the wider population, yeah, it probably would make a difference if this was one of 10 albums. It maybe wouldn't have the same following that it did. I think the story around how the band dissolved after it and how Mangum kind of retreated into the shadows afterwards really heightens this as an experience and as a product, I guess. For me, I don't think any of that changes it. I didn't know any of that when I first heard it, and I only really dove into it after a bunch of listens, after I was already hooked on it. So that kind of, it maybe, that mythology around it maybe heightens the experience of experiencing it, I guess, but it doesn't impact the initial feeling that I had and my main feeling about it, which is like, this music is incredible. It makes me feel things that other music really hasn't, and captures my attention in a way that is very rare, and I'm very glad that it does that.
I think it's a really special album. I like that it is there as an album, and I like the fact that it is kind of this untouchable thing, and that is something that I can return to. Like, in 2013, they toured Australia, and I saw them at the Forum, which is this really beautiful venue, but the live performance didn't really... I don't remember it as being anything particularly spectacular. But this album is something that I come back to. So I think that for me, it's just kind of this thing that encapsulated whatever it was that he was going through at that time, and whatever the band produced at that time. And it is just this special artifact of a strange and fascinating and scary worldview of a person that is probably all of those things. But I'm glad that he did this.
You guys talked favorite tracks, right? Abby, you did. Ian, did you? I think you mentioned O Comely was your favorite, right?
Yeah, O Comely, Two-Headed Boy Part 2, Two-Headed Boy in the Aeroplane Over the Sea, King of Carrot Flowers Part 1. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff on there.
Yeah.
With the exception of I Love You, Jesus Christ. that is the only bit that really grates on me.
I didn't dislike any of the tracks on here. I thought they were all good. I have asterisks in particular next to Two-Headed Boy Part 2 in particular. I think that's my favourite on the album, and O Comely. But yeah, I'd happily listen to any and all of these songs again, and I will.
And as an album. Like, I think it's an album you listen to start to end, and you're just like, yep, this is it.
Yep, and like you said, less than 40 minutes. There's no, like, deluxe version. There's no, like, here's six bonus tracks you have to listen to. Nah. 37 minutes, in and out.
As an aside, carrot flowers are really pretty.
Okay.
Yeah, in case you didn't know, what the wild carrot flower, it looks like lace a little bit. They're like little tufts of many, many little white flowers. They're really pretty.
That is pretty.
So I was listening to the first two tracks, and I was like, what the hell's a carrot flower?
Oh, they are pretty.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're really pretty. Some are purple. Have you seen the purple ones?
I've disappeared down the rabbit hole of Quora, which is one of the best and worst places on the internet. Should I let my carrots flower? And somebody called Scott Krager from Portland, Oregon says, absolutely, if you're into a bit of garden anarchy and botanical flourish.
We should start a garden podcast.
A garden podcast? On top of our reading podcast once you finish Iron Flame?
Yeah.
Wait, no. Fourth Wing. Iron Flame is the next one.
Is a sequel,
I would actually not recommend reading Iron Flame.
I was going to say, if you don't like it,
Fourth
then...
Wing and...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Read Fourth Wing and then as a standalone. Just leave it at that. Spoilers. I'll start off the ratings. I rate this a 7.5 out of 10.
Okay. That's higher than I thought you were going to give it.
You don't know me as well as you think you do.
Ooh. Daggers.
Ian,
you go for it.
I think Matt should go last.
9.5.
Ooh, is that the highest you've given something? I'm gonna just quickly scroll back through our spreadsheet here, Ian. That might be.
I reckon Sophie and Stevens probably.
That is the highest score you've ever given, Ian.
What was second? Carrie and Lowell?
I think so. And Slow Right for New Zero Canada.
Yeah, I mean this loses 0.5.
Jesus Christ, I love you.
Yeah. Without that one line, it'd be a 10.
I think it's a. Oh, it has to be a 9.5 for me as well. I think anything less than that is not reflective of the impact this has had, both initially and since. So, yeah, 9.5 out of 10 for me. It's a good one.
My turn?
Yeah, what are we listening to besides Lizzie McAlpine?
Yeah, so I'm gonna say my pick now, and then next week we'll have a special bonus episode on Older, because as Matt pointed out in our WhatsApp group, Lizzie McAlpine has been a huge part of this podcast, and we all really like Lizzie McAlpine, so it'll be nice to revisit her album with you guys, or I guess visit her album with you guys. So we'll do Older next week as a special episode, but on our regular episode trajectory, my pick for the next my pick for the next episode.
I liked your little hand movement there where you're like trajectory.
You know, it always bothers me when podcasts have YouTube videos as well. I'm like, if you're a podcast, why do you have to make a YouTube video? The whole point is that it's an audio medium. But sometimes I do think that this podcast would be pretty funny as a YouTube video.
Yeah, I agree.
There are facial expressions thrown around that it's a bummer that people can't see them, you know?
That's for our Patreon subscribers,
right? I had a really hard time picking a pick for this, and I would just pick Taylor Swift's album, The Tortured Poets Department, that comes out tomorrow as we're recording this episode. I even wore my shirt for you guys.
Very nice.
Red, Taylor's version.
It's mainly
but
white, actually.
I'm going to pick an... What?
It's mainly white, actually, the shirt. Sorry.
It is. As you were.
Oh, there she is.
I'm going to pick an album that I've mentioned a couple times on the podcast already, but I assume that neither of you have listened to it, given that I don't think that either of you have listened to Sofiane Pommer yet as well. I pick... Ian's typing him in right now. My pick for the next episode is going to be The Last Dinner Party's Prelude to Ecstasy. Taking a big swing from a 1998 album to an album that came out just like a couple months ago. I think it'll be a fun album to talk about.
Very cool. Been meaning to listen to their stuff, and this will give me a good reason to do so.
And then I will convince you guys to do a special episode on the Tortured Poets Department, because that's how this whole podcast started, was Taylor Swift. So we can't not record an episode about it. I feel like it would be, I don't know, not fitting of our brand.
It would be like going from not recording an episode for 6 weeks to recording three in the space of a week.
Yeah, maybe we should just try to really buckle down and record 6 episodes for the next 6 weeks.
Oh, that'd be good.
We'll do this episode, which is already recorded, so one is done.
In the
bank. The second one can be Lizzie McAlpine, and then Last Dinner Party, and then Taylor Swift, and then the next pick, which is yours, Ian, and then one more bonus episode.
What a
we're good.
Take the rest of the year off.
Sound that hard.
What a treat.
Well,
for
never done.
All those listeners that kind of watched the time extend from when we last recorded our last episode, thinking this podcast is done. I've heard the last of the album files. Not only do they get a new episode, they're going to get 6 episodes in 6 weeks. Like, what a treat.
And then we're going to leave for another 2 months because then it'll be July and Ian will have the Tour de France.
And it's a real feast or famine.
Another episode. Yeah. Our next episode will be in late August.
It's either like daily or quarterly.
I think our listeners are kind of used to that at this point. I don't think that they come here for
quality chat.
Normality. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening to this episode. We'll be back next week to talk about Lizzie McAlpine Older. Please listen to it. And maybe grab a box of tissues while you do. And thanks you guys for chatting music with me.
This is fun. Thank you.
Thanks.